This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing absolute return funds for all kinds of investors. Details at putnam.com. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We'd like to think that in a free market, all companies are created equal. Truth is, there are some companies that are more equal than others, the big ones mostly, and there aren't too many bigger than General Electric, which leads to this observation. In a recession, sometimes the bigger they are, the harder they really do fall. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build stronger customer relationships through email marketing. ConstantContact.com. And by Cargill, collaborate, create, succeed. This is how Cargill works with customers. Stories online at CargillCreates.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. You made it to another Friday, everybody. This one's the 23rd of January. Great to have you here. General Electric is one of those companies that's got outsized influence. It's one of the Dow Industrials. It's been thought of as a bellwether for the stock market for decades now. It's been a pretty solid company for just about as long. Today, though, General Electric posted massive losses for the fourth quarter. 2009 is not going to be any better either. The exact phrase from the company today was extremely difficult. Marketplace's Elisa Roth has more now from New York.
Look at what General Electric does, and you realize its name is actually pretty apt. The company makes light bulbs and appliances. It also builds jet engines, and it owns most of the media giant NBC Universal.
But a significant portion of their earnings in recent quarters has come from their finance area. So it makes them vulnerable to the effects of the recent credit crisis.
That's Richard Sparks. He's an equities analyst with Schaefer's Investment Research. He says that's part of why the company's earnings fell by more than 40% in the last quarter. After all, what financial company is doing well right now? On the other hand, GE's solid reputation means investors get nervous when it runs into trouble. Eric Ristabin is with Russell Investments.
What you're seeing with GE is just it's a name people know, and it's making people realize that the economic weakness that we're experiencing is now translating directly into earnings.
Even so, investors will still get a dividend from GE. The company says it has cash on the balance sheet, and it's the right thing to do. Ristabin says that's a risky bet.
The reality is that in most cases, the best balance sheet asset in terms of quality is cash.
And of course, it takes cash to pay out dividends. Ristabin says it's a calculation a lot of companies will have to make this year. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
President Obama met with congressional leaders at the White House today. They've gathered to mull over their differences on the best way to kickstart the economy. Senate Democrats issued their stimulus proposal. It's got more tax cuts and less spending than the House version that came out a week or so ago. House leaders are going to try to pass their bill sometime next week over the objections of a large number of Republicans. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale took a look at the differences.
Most of the $825 billion in the House Democrats' stimulus package would be spent on infrastructure and job creation projects. Tax breaks make up only 40% of the total. Senate Democrats today issued a $700 billion proposal, more than half in the form of tax cuts. That's more to the liking of Republicans, who believe lower taxes would be a quicker boost to the economy. and they'd like to scale back the overall size. House Minority Leader John Boehner spoke to reporters after the White House meeting.
We believe that spending nearly $1 trillion is really more than what we ought to be putting on the backs of our kids and their kids.
Let me see. I think the package should be bigger.
Mark Zandi of Economy.com doesn't think the question comes down to spending versus tax cuts. Since interest rates are at record lows, why can't the government borrow enough to do both?
I would, if I were king for the day, expand the package and I would increase the size of the tax cuts. While it doesn't pack the same economic punch as spending, it doesn't create as many jobs, you can get into the economy quickly, and the economy needs help here and now.
President Obama meets with Republicans on Capitol Hill next week to attract more bipartisan support for a stimulus package. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
You can file this next story in the My How Times Have Changed category. A year ago, before the words financial crisis had really entered the vernacular, there was another phrase making the rounds. Sovereign wealth funds, those huge pools of money that other governments were gathering and spending, oftentimes spending it here, buying whatever struck their fancy, shares in big Wall Street banks or even retail outfits. Dubai's investment fund bought the high-end chain Barney's a little more than a year ago. Now it's looking to sell, a sign that sovereign wealth might not be so wealthy anymore. Marketplace's Sam Eaton reports.
At the height of the boom, Dubai's purchase of Barney's for nearly $1 billion seemed to fit nicely into its opulent spending spree back home. But that was before the global economic crisis soured Dubai's strategy of becoming an international hub for luxury tourism and business. Harvard's Kenneth Rogoff is a former chief economist at the International Monetary Fund.
Dubai has borrowed tons of money to build buildings. They've built islands. There are cranes everywhere. And now they're desperate for cash.
But Dubai may be the exception when it comes to sovereign wealth funds offloading U.S. assets, especially those in the financial sector, where shares have plunged. University of Maryland business professor Peter Morisi.
These sovereign wealth funds have been burned in the financial sector, and it's likely too late for them to get out.
China invested billions in U.S. banks. Selling now wouldn't make much sense. But Harvard's Kenneth Rogoff says China has learned a valuable lesson.
They're beside themselves with joy that they lost so much money because it so unnerved them that they didn't invest in anything else. They held on to treasury bills.
Which raises an entirely different set of problems.
There's a concern that China, other holders of treasury bills, might say, hey, wait a second, look at how much money the U.S. is printing. Look at how much debt the U.S. is running up. These things are going to become worthless.
And if that spooks foreign investors into unloading their treasury bills, he says you can kiss low interest rates and lack of inflation goodbye. I'm Sam Eaton for Marketplace.
Speaking of inflation, as Sam said, it's not like we've got any now, but oil traders sure are trying. Crude jumped 6% today, accompanied by a mixed day on Wall Street. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Yahoo is the latest technology company looking to cut costs. Word out of Silicon Valley today is that new CEO Carol Bartz has declared a pay freeze. That's one alternative to layoffs that a number of companies are opting for as the economy sinks deeper into recession. Not getting a raise so people can keep their jobs is one thing. Getting a pay cut, though, is quite another, as Marketplace's Jeremy Hobson reports from New York.
If you had the choice between a pay cut of, say, 10% and layoffs at your company, which would you pick?
I would take a pay cut because I don't want to see anybody else go.
I'd take a little pay cut. I'd feel better about myself and if I was helping out the company, but I don't know if everyone's like me.
They're not.
I'd prefer laying people off because I think that there are plenty of people at my firm who aren't carrying their weight.
The problem is 39% of companies have already trimmed their workforces. That's according to a recent survey by the human resources firm Watson Wyatt. But Laura Siegen, one of the firm's practice directors, says for many companies, layoffs are only part of the story.
Either before resorting to layoffs or in addition to layoffs, companies are trying other tactics. So they're doing a hiring freeze, or they're doing a salary freeze, or they're putting restrictions in place on company travel.
Or they're cutting salaries. The Watson Wyatt survey found 5% of companies have already done so, a number that is expected to double in the coming year. Joe Prabhu thinks that's an understatement. She runs the recruiting firm International Services Group.
In this current economy, there is no yardstick. Layoffs are happening daily. Companies are reorganizing daily because there is no money, there is no credit, there is no way for them to pay their salaries.
Prabhu says just as home values were too high during the boom, some salaries were too high. And now they're correcting.
Actually, this happened to my son. His salary was being cut by 15%, and he asked me to look for other positions for him. But the fact of the matter is I advised him to stay within his current job because the possibility of him getting another job with the same or higher salary is almost slim to none.
The choice between layoffs and pay cuts isn't easy for managers either. Some see layoffs as better for morale because everyone affected is gone. Psychologist Ken DeMeese has been studying the workplace for decades. He says layoffs can lead to stress and guilt for employees who stick around. That means reduced productivity and higher health care costs for the company. DeMeese says cutting pay means everyone feels the pain.
But it does tend to foster how can we work together to save our company, to save our jobs, rather than creating a situation of haves and have-nots.
DeMeese says research shows that for a pay cut to work, it's got to happen from top to bottom. Executives have to share in the pain.
Secondly, there has to be a communication that it's temporary, that once the economy turns around, that your pay will be brought back to the level it once was and hopefully increased because you've shown good faith to stay with this company and now we're going to compensate you accordingly.
Whatever the payoff is in the future, experts say all Americans should brace for the possibility of salary cuts because right now it's definitely an employer's market. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson for Marketplace.
I could set up our weekly wrap of events from Wall Street and beyond today with a detailed recap of the news. That banks are still cratering and the layoffs are still coming. That Congress is trying to hammer out a stimulus package and Treasury Secretary hopeful Timothy Geithner promises to get tough with the TARP. Or I could just say Barack Obama and then introduce David Leonhardt of The New York Times and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Hi, guys.
Hello, Kai.
Hi, Kai.
All right, you guys. So it's been 72 hours plus or minus since President Obama's been on the job. And I know that's a short track record. But David, what's your sense so far of how he's doing economy-wise?
I would say on the little test, which is his speech, he did a really good job. I think there was a lot that was very good in that speech. This notion that we are not only in a crisis, but we've had a long period in which we haven't made the hard choices, as he said, that we need to for the economy. So on the small measure, I think it was good. The much bigger question is what they're going to do with the stimulus package. And I think we just don't know yet. I mean, is this going to be good in that it gets the economy moving, but full of pork and does nothing to solve our long-term problems? Or is it going to start to solve the long term problems but not do enough to stimulate the economy? Or is it really going to be the right mixture of both?
All right, let's put that thought on hold for a second. And Lee, let me get your short-term take on the new president.
Short-term, I think it's great. I mean, I agree with David. I think he struck absolutely the right tone. It was a very sobering tone. You know, right out of the gate, I think some of the moves he made on the first day, you know, even something simple as freezing salaries among his aides, I mean, that really, you know, makes a big statement, says that these are serious times and things in Washington are going to be no different.
All right, well, let's pick up on the stimulus package question then, and let me get your take on what David said. Is it going to be productive and effective, or are we going to get bogged down, or someplace in the middle?
Some of this falls down on basic party lines, and we saw that just with the GOP coming out with their own proposal for a different kind of stimulus plan. But I think that the agreement is that we do need to do something soon. And I mean, you know, Obama's really looking to the 30s for guidance. That's how big this problem is. And he sees very much spending as the way out of it. The key here, though, is, I mean, there's a lot of talk about spending soon, getting these so-called shovel-ready projects off the ground, meaning that they're ready basically right now. But that may not even be soon enough. I mean, we really need help literally in the next month or two to start saving jobs.
Well, David, I mean, you know, the Speaker of the House, Nancy Pelosi, came out today and said she's confident that it's going to hit that mid-February deadline. The president said it yesterday. Are you buying that?
Yeah, I think I am. When you combine the fact that they are the same party, the congressional control in the White House, and the fact that a huge number of people in the Obama White House came from Congress, not only the president and the vice president, but Rahm Emanuel and a whole bunch of other people. So I think it is likely that it's going to happen by mid-February, and I think they are going to make a big push to have a lot of the spending happening soon. But as Lee points out, it's not going to happen soon enough in some ways. At this point, it's almost guaranteed that the economy gets worse for nearly all of 2009. The job market, which is how most people experience the economy, tends to lag the rest of the economy. And so at this point, it's all but sure that that's going to happen. The question is how much worse, and can we avoid this sort of self-reinforcing cycle in which we end up with a problem that's even worse than where we are now?
Lee, pick up on that point and talk to me about expectations. The president-elect a week and a month and 2 months ago worked really hard at setting expectations and saying, you know, it's going to get worse before it gets better. Now that he's on the job, is he appropriately setting expectations for the economy and for our ability to fix it?
I think so. I mean, I think he's being very careful in the message that he sends. But I think the bigger question in terms of what he's going to do really, especially this week, concerns the remaining $350 billion in the TARP plan and whether he's going to add some help for the banks as part of the stimulus plan or whether he's going to treat that separately with whatever he does with the TARP. I mean, I think this week the markets were really jolted by what happened with the financials.
I think that's a really important point because to some extent you can't get stimulus into the pipeline tomorrow. But you can take steps that shore up the financial system, if not tomorrow, then almost tomorrow. So I think it's important to keep in mind that there are really two tracks here. And in some ways, the one that can have the first effect is the TARP and these efforts to get the financial system working a little bit better.
At some point, though, do you think, David, that the public and Congress just runs out of patience and something snaps?
Maybe. And I do think it's going to be important to take a tougher line toward banks than Congress has so far. I'd be very surprised if we get enough of a backlash that what the public demands is that the White House and Congress stop trying to deal with these problems.
Lee Gallagher at Fortune Magazine. David Leonhardt is a columnist for The New York Times. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, religious rites of passage in a recession.
I've seen tropical parties with dancing hula girls and the child ushered in like some ancient Hawaiian potentate.
But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial slid 45 points today, a 0.5%, closed at 8,077. The NASDAQ gained 11.8%, settled at 1,477. The S&P 500 rebounded 4 points, 0.5%, wrapped up at 831. For the week, the Dow ended down 2.5%. The NASDAQ sliced off 3.4%. The S&P 500 lost 2.2%. Financial stocks rose. Citigroup climbed 11.5%. Today, JPMorgan Chase ascended a bit more than 5%. Bank of America pulled up 9.25%. Rising commodity prices, as I mentioned, gave energy stocks a boost. Chevron nudged up 1.25%. ConocoPhillips gained a few ticks. Investors turned out the lights on GE after it reported that huge drop in profits we told you about, down 11% today. Bond prices fell. That sent the yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.61%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals at Vanguard.com. Let us do the work for you. Download Marketplace's After the Bell, a podcast which makes sense of a week's worth of business news. Just go to marketplace.org and click on the podcast link.
Here's a glance at the Marketplace Datebook for events coming up Monday. In Washington, the National Association of Realtors reports on sales of existing homes for December. In New York, the Conference Board releases leading economic indicators for December. And the Year of the Ox begins. Happy Chinese New Year. I'm Michelle Phillippe. Have a great weekend.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. High-speed internet providers got a boost yesterday from the House Energy and Commerce Committee. Lawmakers set aside $6 billion to expand broadband access. That nod to the tech industry comes as President Obama and his BlackBerry settle into the Oval Office. Obama is likely to be the first emailing president and the first to use a laptop. He's also committed to posting a weekly video address on YouTube. All of that should probably have been expected, given how tech-friendly the Obama campaign was. And he's promised a tech-friendly presidency, too, in part by hiring the government's first chief technology officer. Declan McCullough covers Washington for CNET News. Good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
Maybe what we ought to do is start with talking about what this job might be, since it's the first time we'll ever have one. What's your thought on that?
We don't know yet. We're kind of in a wait-and-see approach, that is, the people who are following this question. One possibility is that this is someone doing technology policy for the administration, saying, hey, this is what privacy rules should be. This is what where we're going to stand on things like broadband regulation and net neutrality. Another possibility, and probably a more likely one, is that the CTO will instead be the federal government's IT czar. This is someone who will try to get the federal computers moved into the late 20th century. And that by itself...
Say that again, late 20th century, right?
The late 20th century. And that by itself is a huge, huge problem. We ran a story a year or two ago about how the Department of Homeland Security was still using index cards to keep track of immigration requests and visa status changes. I mean, this is very old technology.
Yeah. Is that possibly a reason we need one? Because it is so tough to get the government up to current standards in technology.
I think that's a very good argument for one. Some decisions benefit from centralization, and this could be one of them, sort of an overall strategy, and especially an overall strategy when it comes to putting more government information online. This is something that candidate Obama promised during the campaign. And to his credit, this is something that President Obama did. One of the first official acts he took was to direct all federal agencies to be more open and put more stuff on the internet, and also charged the CTO with making this happen within 120 days.
Well, who might it be then? There is a list of candidates out there, rumored to be sure.
There is a list of candidates. There's at least a list of rumors, as you said. The question is, will the president choose someone who is maybe more Silicon Valley-focused, someone like Google CEO Eric Schmidt, who has, in fact, said he doesn't want the job, so maybe it's unfair to speculate about him, but someone who understands how to run a large technology company and then can take those lessons learned to the federal government, or someone like, Washington, D.C., the city's own CTO has been talked about as a potential appointee, someone who understands the way a government bureaucracy works and has done a good job and then can translate that to the federal government writ large.
You know, it's going to be pretty easy to know whether the stimulus plan has worked because the economy will get better. It'll be easy to figure out foreign policy because some of the hotspots might clear up. How are we going to know whether this technology officer has done a good job?
It's a good question and something to ask the CTO once we know who he or she's going to be.
We'll get him or her on the phone and straighten that right up.
There are a few things you can look at. I mean, if the portfolio includes cybersecurity, how many successful computer intrusions are there? If the portfolio includes how transparent agencies are, then you can look at how quickly agencies update their website and post important news on there. I mean, it's going to be difficult to measure, I think, but not impossible.
Declan McCullough is the chief political correspondent for CNET News. Declan, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Depending on where you grew up, bar or bat mitzvahs were some of the landmarks of your early adolescence. Bar is the one for a boy, bats are for girls. They're the religious ceremonies that mark a Jewish child's move into adulthood, ceremonies that are followed shortly thereafter by the party. Back before the economy went into the tank, those celebrations had gotten a little over the top, competitive even. Rebecca Shear reports the recession may be crashing the party now.
The 2006 movie Keeping Up with the Steins opens at a bar mitzvah celebration with a Titanic theme and budget. The bar mitzvah boy sails into the ballroom on a replica of the Titanic. Alongside him, a killer whale, a real one, wearing a yarmulke and leaping through a Star of David.
Today I am the king of the Torah!
The scene is intended as satire, but in some cases, it looks a lot like real life.
I've seen tropical parties with dancing hula girls and the child ushered in like some ancient Hawaiian potentate.
That's Rabbi David Wolpe of Sinai Temple in Los Angeles. He's seen kids make their grand entrance on horseback. One jumped through a ring of fire. This kind of excess used to be reserved for weddings, Wolpe says, but now?
The only way to have a wedding that would surpass the bar bat mitzvah is to do it in outer space.
And the tab for some bar and bat mitzvahs does reach into the stratosphere. What with the caviar and filet mignon, the $10,000 celebrity impersonator, the elaborate invitations hand-delivered with a goodie bag. But now that the economy has, well, plotzed, people are bringing their parties back to earth.
They may say, you know, I want to plan a beautiful bar bat mitzvah for my child, but I know I also have to pay for college 5 years from now, and so maybe we don't do the world's craziest thing.
Gabrielle Stone is an event planner in Cambridge, Massachusetts. She says even if you're not doing the world's craziest thing,
if you have any event that has 100 guests and you're serving a full meal and you're having music,
and you've skipped the martini bar, the five-story centerpieces, and the souvenir bar mitzvah boy t-shirts,
possibly the bare minimum might be somewhere around $20,000, $15,000.
To beat that, Stone says, people are trimming their guest lists to family and close friends, trading steak for chicken or vegetarian, hiring a DJ, not a band, and ditching those flashy invitations for ones you can download and print out yourself. Ellen Clapper is planning her daughter's bat mitzvah in Newton, Massachusetts, and trying to keep it simple. As a mortgage banker, she's plenty familiar with the financial downturn.
In this economy where people are so struggling and there's no light at the end of the tunnel, to do something so outlandish wouldn't be sort of in line with what's happening in the big world.
Nor, she says, would it be in line with what a bar or bat mitzvah is supposed to be, a sacred rite of passage where a 13-year-old child takes on the mitzvah, or divine commandment, of making that big world a better place. As Rabbi David Wolpe sees it, the recession might be just the thing to encourage people to focus more on the mitzvah and less on, well, the bar.
It may be one of those times, one of those rare times when economic trial helps spiritual health, because this is about the quality of your soul and not the size of your bank book.
And given that today's 13-year-olds will one day inherit all of our economic mishigas, spending less just might be a mitzvah in and of itself. I'm Rebecca Shear for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, offering absolute return funds with goals designed to match yours. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, courtesy of our friends at CNBC. Bob Pisani is one of their reporters on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange. He's a nice guy. I've met him once. But I think he got a little sidetracked today talking about rumors of a big merger in the drug industry.
Hey, the heck with the pharmaceuticals. What the market needs now is medicinal marijuana. That's what we need right now. We need a bong break. The whole country needs a bong break.
Dude, I mean, right? Come on. Oh, man. This is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow fell 45 points, a half percent. The NASDAQ rose 11 points, 0.8%. The S&P 500 bumped up 4 points, 0.5% there as well. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Weston. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. Coming up on Monday, even recession-proof industries feel the pinch.
Healthcare used to be the area where it's a safe job, but that's not true anymore, I think, personally.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Have yourself a great weekend.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.